Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we'll be talking with Mr. Brad Busey, the Managing Director of Security Strategy at a security firm known as Trace3 based in Irvine, California. Brad, thanks for your time and let's go ahead and get started, please.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Before we started the show, we looked up your bio quite extensively on Google and on LinkedIn, and you seem to have a really rich and deep background in cybersecurity. Can you tell us some of the highlights of your career and what brought you into cybersecurity and any of your biggest achievements?
Yeah, absolutely. So oddly enough, I started my career building computers in my dad's warehouse. He was an IBM business partner and had a business for a number of years. So I was, 9, 10, 11-year-old, putting together 286s and 386s. And it really sparked my interest for technology. So I went to college, got a degree in information system security, and then started working as a contractor for the DoD. So I worked at NORAD and U.S. Northern Command for a number of years.
Oh, wow.
And that really, I would say, kicked off the pretty hardcore security part of my background. And then I went on to Quest Software, where I was a SE and then an architect. So I was a sales engineer turned architect and worked with a lot of three-letter agencies. So it was federal, state and local, DoD, and got to go to some of the coolest places. I mean, obviously, NORAD is pretty cool, but getting to go to the Pentagon and seeing some of the pieces of the NSA, that was pretty amazing. So I really liked security. I liked the software. And I was at a point in my career where I wanted to see what it was like to actually build a product. So I went over to a data security software company and designed and helped to stand up a couple of products, some around Active Directory reporting, as well as data governance, and had a really good time there. I got to see how the sauce was made and really thought, I've kind of done a lot of different things. Maybe I'll go out on my own. So I started my own security consultancy, did that for just a couple of months, and that's when I met the SVP of consulting at Trace3 and had a really good conversation with him about how to scale my own business and really doing that inside of Trace3. So he gave me a great opportunity, and I was able to come on and lead security strategy for Trace3.
Excellent. Hey, just a kind of a quick question. Do you remember the movie War Games, like when it came out in the 1980s? Is NORAD just like that, like deep in the mountains and all those big
cities
and everything? Or? Okay, wow.
Yeah, I can't say too much about it, which is funny because I still, I still have to not talk too much, but it's very much like that, where you go through a tunnel and you feel like you're in a cave, and it's very kind of damp. But then you go into the buildings, and you feel like you're in an office, or you feel like you're when you're walking the halls, you feel like you're on a ship, believe it or not. So there's some specifics around how they designed their buildings. So it's a pretty interesting place.
Sure. Now, is Trace3 a company that you've actually helped to create? I mean, are you like a partner or so in this company?
I would say I'm helping to create the security part of Trace3. So Trace3 has been around since 2002 and started in storage, compute, and networking as a value-added reseller and systems integrator. But what we realized coming into like 2015, 16, 17, before I was there, was the fact that security was a really big part that I think we were missing And pretty much everything that you deploy has an element of security or should have an element of security. So we decided to really double down and focus on security, data intelligence, and cloud.
Okay. Now, how long has Trace 3 been in business?
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, probably coming up on 20 years now. So it's pretty, as companies go, I would say it's growing rapidly. And we've gone from, you know, just like a, we'll say $500 million company in the last couple of years, we're over $1 billion now.
Congratulations. Wow, that's really a good growth rate. Now, how did you get the name Trace 3? Because whenever I interview a C-level executive like yourself from a cybersecurity company, I always ask them about their name because there's always some, you know, meaning behind why they chose that. What does Trace 3 mean? Is there any relevance to it to cybersecurity, or what is the, or how does it tie into cybersecurity?
Yeah, so that goes back to our founder, Hayes Drumright. And very early on, we were a NetApp reseller. And we'd have to get Hayes to really, I think, give us a good conversation about Trace 3, because a lot of people are always like, well, is it 3-3? Because Trace in Spanish is 3. So I don't actually know the story or really the origin of it. I mean, I always thought it had something to do with our storage and networking roots. And we'd have to ask Hayes.
Okay, not a problem. Now, do you have a presence in other countries as well, or are you just based in the Western U.S. like California?
So that's a good question. So we started in Irvine, California. We were very West Coast focused. It's a fun story saying the East for us was Colorado, where I'm from. And very recently, we acquired another company known as DSI. And that really gave us a more national presence. Now, we do have customers that are global. So some of our engineers and architects fly to Germany and lots of other places in Europe to really service those customers. But primarily, we are U.S.-based, national, moving ever eastward.
Okay. Now, who is your typical customer base like? Are you trying to target the small and medium-sized businesses, the larger companies like the Fortune 500, or is it a combination of both of these?
So it's a combination of both. And, you know, as a systems integrator and value-added reseller, we were pretty focused on enterprise, large enterprise, state and local government, and DoD. And since we are acquiring companies, that has helped round us out and added more of the small, medium business, enterprise, mid-level enterprise. They did have some enterprise customers as well, but it's really helped to give us the ability to cover a wide range of customers, which has been really good for the business.
Excellent. Now, let's get into your product and service line. It sounds like Trace 3 has distinct lines in security strategy, identity management, data security, endpoint security, network security, as well as vulnerability management. Could you elaborate on these in a little bit more detail and how you use them in cybersecurity? And how are they made available to your customers? I know a lot of cybersecurity solutions now are, you know, they're now being made available on the cloud as a service to make it easier for the customer to use. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So most of what we do really comes down to being a systems integrator and a consultancy. So most everything we do revolves around understanding our customer's problem, the challenges with solving that problem, and then helping them to discover a solution. And that solution is often a real mix of people, process, and technology. And we provide the people. We provide a unique process based on, I'd say, decades of experience for a lot of our engineers and architects. And then I would say some of the best and most innovative technology solutions on the market. We'll talk a little bit about some of our innovation, I'm thinking, throughout the podcast. But Trace3 is very well connected with the venture capitalist community in Silicon Valley. So we know where the market is going, I think, before a lot of others, just because you can kind of see where VCs are putting their money, who they're backing, why they're backing them. And we've got our fingers on the pulse of that, which has been very good for our customers. And so much of what we do is really just based on, you know, those soft skills. So does Trace3 have an actual product of our own? We don't. So being that reseller, you know, we have pretty much every hardware vendor, software, anything you can think of, we've got partnerships with them. So we just help to make sure that we're able to architect, deploy, and secure what it is that that our customers require. So it's a great way to solve problems, because when you come at it just as a vendor, so, you know, previous life, I was building products for an organization. I had a very narrow view of how I could solve those problems, which is always a little frustrating. Where now I can pick, based on the customer's use cases and challenges, I can pick the best solution for the customer, as opposed to saying, well, you have to buy this because that's all that I have. Or we can build a solution around this, but it's going to be a lot of customizations because we're pulling from a very small pool. It's not like that. It's very easy to solve problems for our customers, which is exciting. So as you were saying, from security strategy, identity and access management, we've got solutions for data security, endpoint security, networking and infrastructure, and something near and dear to my heart, vulnerability management and GRC, governance, risk, and compliance.
Okay. Now, can you tell us more about the technological architecture that you use for these services and products?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, really our strength and the strength in that architecture, it's really built on those decades of industry consulting experience. So Trace3 is all about elite engineering, and we are, think of it as like a 7-to-1 ratio. So we have 7 engineers for every account manager in our organization. And we don't just hire like right out of college for our core. So the core of Trace3 is elite engineering. Individuals that have been in their space for 15 to 20 years. And then we do have an internship program. We do have a lot of, you know, hiring right out of a college, but that's more to build them up into those elite engineers. So the core of the business mentors the up-and-comers, the ones that are out there architecting in front of customers, solving these big problems. They are our 20-plus year veterans in the space.
Okay, excellent. Now, how do you view security strategy, and how is Trace3 different from the other cybersecurity vendors that are out there?
That's a good question, because you're going to get a different answer depending on how people look at security strategy. So me, you know, I put the lens of being a CCSO and a CISSP and just being in security for a long time. I like to look at the security landscape as a whole and really baseline, like, what is the current state of the organization that I'm helping? or even my own organization, and then identify, like, what are the security concerns that we have? What are some of the risks? What are some of the threats? Because based on industry, some of those things may be a little different. You know, is HIPAA a consideration? Is PCI a consideration? You know, what kind of a framework are you following? You know, I'm a big fan of NIST. I'm a big fan of CIS 20. And you just have to have a laser focus on how to mitigate the risks and the threats. What's an acceptable risk? What isn't? And it's interesting because when you say security and you say security strategy, people often get a little fuzzy on what exactly that entails. So I like to break it down into the 10 components or domains of something like a CISSP, because it makes it a little more bite-sized. Because I always tell people that work with me, like, we have an elephant. We got to eat that elephant. It's an old adage. How do you eat the elephant? Well, you got to eat it one bite at a time. So when I'm explaining security strategy or identifying some area of risk, I like to be able to put it into different buckets, like security architecture, physical security. I'd say one of the most important, access control systems. What are the methodologies behind that? It's pretty important as well to understand application and systems development, because that's an emerging space, and trying to get these app developers to start taking a security first approach to app development and shifting all of that left, shifting security left, like, that's become a pretty major thing. So I'd say, you know, that's kind of how I view security strategy. It's just putting all of those pieces together, understanding what you have, where you're trying to go, and what kinds of governance do you need, and making sure that really you have a good idea of what it is your business is actually doing for its customers. Because there are areas where I've noticed businesses take more risk maybe than they should. And I think it's because they don't really understand their core, like, people, process, technology, and the impact that's going to have on their end customer.
Excellent. Now, how do your services protect identities? Because, you know, identity management is one of the huge hot topics in cybersecurity today.
Yeah, we have an identity management practice, and we have a pretty awesome industry leader at the helm of that practice, and he's a full bird colonel, and he's got over 20 years of experience protecting not only organizations, but our nation. And I mean, our team has really an impressive amount of experience defending against attackers targeting identities. And, you know, this guy has a very similar background to me, except for he was actually serving. So he was in Cyber Command and has an impressive pedigree and a very good way of protecting identities. So that's, I'd say, one of our strongest security practices within Trace3.
Excellent. Now, as we all know, you know, smartphone mobile security is very much a hot button topic today. In fact, my last infographic newsletter was all about the mobile security threat landscape and tips how to protect yourself. Tell us more about that. I mean, have you dealt with anything on that? What are your viewpoints on that?
Yeah, I think that mobile threat defense is an often overlooked piece of what organizations are doing. A lot of them may have some level of mobile device management for devices that they own. And there are solutions out there where you can have split profiles. So half your phone is business, half is yours. And, you know, there's ways to do that. But I'm starting to lump a lot of mobile and mobile security into Internet of Things. And I treat them very similar. So I'd say we've got a pretty commanding presence when it comes to mobile device management, mobile threat defense, IoT. We've got a practice that partners with a lot of emerging and innovative technologies that are really focused around those Internet of Things, as far as, you know, how do those look in the organization? So, you know, if I'm looking at that traffic, typically it has to pass through a network. So understanding that network layer and being able to understand what should those devices be doing. You know, if I'm looking at a device, I wanna understand what should it be talking to, what ports, what kinds of things should it be doing. So there's a lot of good technology out there that actually helps us do that. So it'll allow you to examine the ingress and egress points for your IoT, and even start to wrap some controls and protection. And I'd love to talk about IoT a little bit more. I don't want to go off on a tangent for a mobile question, but yeah, we've got a really good understanding and some good ways of protecting our customers. And, you know, I've got some thoughts on how maybe some of your listeners can protect themselves, even at home, things that,
right,
that
right.
I've thought of over the years. Like, here's just some good rules of thumb.
Yeah. In fact, I was going to ask you, it's funny that we were thinking the same thing about the Internet of Things, the IoT. You know, I've written a couple of blogs. I've written some articles for some clients on that. And me personally, I find that to be a very scary proposition, because it just scares me to think how everything is all connected together. And there are two problems I have with that. One, if one point of connection breaks down, that leads to a cascading effect. And two, we're just increasing attack surface for the cyber attack, and there's really no security measures out there. So, I mean, we can make a whole different podcast on the IoT, but just really quickly, like, what are your thoughts on that, on the Internet of Things? I mean, just from a like a customer or consumer standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a lot of thoughts, and I think I try to begin with the end in mind. So if you've ever read, you know, seven highly effective things for that that budding professional, I would say that not enough of the IoT vendors that are, or even traditional vendors, like let's say a refrigerator, they're building in the ability to, let's say, Wi-Fi connect it so you can monitor the temperature, or you can set like shelf life for specific food in there and then auto reorder based on if it's still present. They're just not building security first. So they're creating this device that can get on the internet, but they're not thinking about, well, how do we keep it secure? How do we keep it from being accessed from the outside? And then the next thing you know, somebody is, you know, a hacker's playing a practical joke, and they raise the temperature in your freezer to 50 or 60 degrees, and all your food spoils. What does that cost? So just building in security when they are creating these systems or enhancements. And it's going to be, I think, easier soon to say what isn't connected to the internet than what is, because I think pretty much everything is going to be connected in one way or another, because we're all about just automation as a nation, I would say, and making things as easy as possible, making sure that you can start the washer or dryer, or stop or start the dishwasher, or, you know, I can name a bunch of different things. But a lot of the things, so like you, I know I do a lot of writing, and one of the questions that I've asked is, just because something can be connected to the internet, Like, should it? And that's, I think, one of the foundational questions that I would ask a lot of the IoT vendors and creators. In building a product, it's like you have a long list of user asks. Users are always like, hey, can you do this? Can you do this? We call them user stories. Well, based on user stories to build internet capabilities into a product, I think product managers should really look at that and understand, is it just marketing? Are you just trying to keep up with your competition and offer the same and be me too? And if it were me and I'd say, well, we have to do it because our customers are asking them for it, then you need to secure it. And that should be the first thing that you start thinking about is, how are we going to keep this patched? How are we going to keep it only talking to the update server, make sure it can never be, participate in a botnet. Don't leave it open to the internet. Make sure it doesn't have a default username and password. If it does, make sure it's immediately changed when the user first connects it to the internet. And there's a lot of like best practices that I think our manufacturers could take.
Okay, excellent. Now, how about data security? Can this be made into like as a service from the cloud, or is it an on-prem solution?
I would say I like to think and look at data security as hybrid cloud. So it can be It can be on-prem, it can be in the cloud, and a lot of it starts with user education and really focus on things like data loss prevention, looking at your unstructured data. And what I mean by unstructured data is like your Word files, Excel, PowerPoints, zip files, pictures, all those kinds of things. And understanding simply who has access to what and should they have that access. I like to know, how did they actually get the access? And most importantly, like, what are they doing with that access? So often I come into customers' environments and I sit down and we start reviewing access. And they're like, oh, yeah, we just model everybody after Brad's account. I'm just making up a name. And we give them the same level of access. And we look at what could that person do if they became compromised or if they were an insider. And showing a customer that report will often make them go pale because they realize just how much access users have when they really shouldn't. So being able to run a report like that and being able to do things like, I don't know, I'd say all of your listeners probably have a Box account, Dropbox, OneDrive, some kind of cloud sharing, whether personal or business. Yeah. So being able to tie access to that Box folder to something like multi-factor authentication. And I know you have a very deep biometrics background. So being able to tie a user into something they know, something they have, and then something they are. And phones are actually making that a heck of a lot easier for that something you are. So being able to do Face ID, being able to do fingerprint recognition, typing in your code, having the phone, like those are things to really be able to say, okay, that really is Brad. And knowing that I have a behavior. So back to data security, my behavior probably isn't going to change very much from a day-to-day basis. I pretty much do my job. I'm uploading things. I'm maybe downloading a couple of things. I'm making edits. But the moment that I start maybe going to 5, maybe 10 places in Box that, yeah, I have access, but I've never been there before. And all of a sudden, I'm starting to download a bunch of stuff. I have access to it, but that's unusual for me. We have the ability through just our partners and our architecture and consulting to flag that, to have cyber security go, maybe we should look a little bit deeper into what Brad's doing. He might be compromised. Someone may have access to his credentials, or maybe he's a flight risk. He's looking to leave the company, and he's taking all of our secrets with him. So just some things to think about, and it's all connected, and that's why I say hybrid cloud, because most customers have cloud and on-prem.
Okay. Now, that leads us into identity management. You know, we've talked about two-factor authentication. That's a hot topic today. But now, biometrics, has Trace3 made any use of biometrics in customer engagements? And if so, what kind of modalities have you used?
We have. I'd say most of the biometric components that we've used are integrated into identity management. So it is part of that authentication and authorization piece. So it's challenges. And as far as biometrics, it's built into a piece of software. So for instance, they will leverage, I'd say these are probably the most popular for us, Apple's authentication suite, as well as Samsung or Google's, and being able to tap into that recorded biometric of face ID or fingerprint, and then just replaying that, allowing that to trust, and then sending on to the system, whether it's in the cloud or on-prem, that says, hey, we've verified this user's identity based on Apple's framework or Google's or Samsung's.
Okay, excellent. Now, in cybersecurity, I think endpoint detection, endpoint response security is now becoming a very hot topic, because I think corporate America was always obsessed with protecting the in-between stuff, like the communications line in between a client computer and a server. But now we're paying very close attention now to the client and the client computer and the server as these endpoints and securing them. So I think the cyber attacker is now kind of trying to target that as well. How hot is it, and what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would say what isn't hot in endpoint security? Seems like everybody is trying to get in on it, and I think so much of it is based on those endpoints are interfacing with so many different things. So that's how most attacks and most compromises actually happen. So your user endpoint has access to the internet, has access to email, and can go out to various websites. Individuals can get phishing emails where they click on that email, and next thing you know, they're putting in their user information because they think they're locked out, or we're looking for strange behavior, maybe insider threat. Someone is in there trying to steal secrets. So you'll notice this sounds a little bit familiar because we were just talking about data security, but all of that originates on an endpoint. So getting better understanding of that endpoint, processes that are running on it, that's how a lot of attackers hide different types of malware, is they'll make it mimic another process or another service. So being able to have a better understanding of what is that process doing? So for instance, should Notepad ever communicate with the internet? That's a definite no. So if I notice that Notepad is spawning a process that is then reaching out on port 80 or even port 443, you definitely have a problem. So I think that's why endpoint is so prominent, and that's why there's so many people jumping into it. Antivirus is not the only thing you need anymore. And I think it's been proven that signature-based antivirus is only part of the equation. So you have to look at patterns. You have to look at behavior of processes of the user and how all of that is interfacing, even before it gets to the server. There's a lot of privilege escalation and things that can happen on an endpoint. I still watch administrators sit down to troubleshoot something for a user, and they log on to the user's endpoint with an administrative account. The first thing that I'm going to do as an attacker is I'm going to be able to take that information and escalate my own account. And I've done this, and I've watched this be done hundreds of times. And that's the first thing in like a red teaming engagement that we'll do, is we'll look for those kinds of credentials. So you need endpoint security to not just be antivirus, anti-malware, but you need some patterns, behaviors. You need some process that says, like, your administrator should never log on with administrative credentials to an endpoint. It should always be least privileged, and then you escalate where you need, because that credential isn't saved anywhere. It's used for that session, and then it's gone. Or there's a lot of technology out there as well, where you know you can install something onto that endpoint. It'll grant just admin privileges for a specific session, and then it purges them. So lots of different ways you can approach it, but I'd say some good nuggets of information as to why endpoint security is so incredibly important, and why it's growing, and why we're seeing a lot of the legacy vendors who were all about signature antivirus. They're starting to diversify their portfolio. They're starting to acquire other companies to do other things in security. Because if they were just focused on signature antivirus, they're not in business anymore.
Okay. Interesting. Now, how about application security? How is that exactly done?
So application security is pretty exciting. And you're going to hear terms a lot, like DAST and SAST and RASP. So just think of those as like dynamically assessing code as it's being built, or statically assessing code and applications as they're built and compiled and loaded. You see it a lot in containerization. You see it a lot in newer app development. And RASP is protecting an application in runtime. And really, proper security is built into the application from the beginning. So I would say application security is one of the most important components of security because of that. And so often, you know, I watched developers create code and applications, and security was always an afterthought. And that's why we have so many breaches, to be honest. I mean, you see these application servers where companies are afraid to patch their server because sometimes it breaks their application. And then their service is down, their users are unable to access the application, and all of it because you were trying to do the right thing and issue a patch. So application security nowadays is all about decoupling that from an app server and maybe running it in platform as a service, or running security specifically within the app so that you've got different layers. So you want microservices. You want a microservices architecture. You want your applications to be very fluid and be able to move between containers and container environments, so that, let's say I do need to patch a system. It's very quick because I'm able to move my apps off, patch the system. I've already tested all of this because I've got a good development life cycle. A lot of it's automated, so I can look at some predictive failure, some predictive analytics, get the metrics that I need. So really, if you could see me right now, I'm actually drawing in the air like a life cycle. And application security truly is a life cycle. And it's all about that developing, retesting. It's one of those things where it's never done. Like network security, people are always thinking, well, we stood up our network, we paved all the roads, we're done, right? In some cases with network security, yeah, but not with applications. Not with application security. They are living, breathing things because there are others out there that are motivated to get the information that those applications have or are protecting. And that's why app security is so fundamental.
Okay. Now, can you tell us more about vulnerability management and what separates it from GRC?
Well, I see them both really as necessary for any organization. So vulnerability management, it's focused on vulnerabilities. And it's those vulnerabilities in the enterprise, how to mitigate them. They could be part of software. They could be part of physical infrastructure. You're just looking at what could be compromised. Where governance, risk, and compliance, it gives form and function to making sure that management of the vulnerabilities actually happens. But it gives you a very well-traveled road to follow. You know, there's tons of frameworks out there to help. And you know, Trace3 is pretty awesome because we know, I'd say, pretty much all of them that really matter. You know, NIST, COBIT, CIS-20, you know, we're throwing out frameworks and compliance components. But just having a map and understanding the relationship between the two, because I've been asked, what's the difference between the two? And it's almost like saying, well, what's the difference between an orange and an apple? Well, you know, they're both fruit. They're both important. And I would say to any healthy security diet, I need both of those things.
Excellent. Now, what other unique service offerings does Trace3 offer?
Well, I would say we've got some pretty interesting things. We've got workshops. We have some pretty unique assessments. But you'll see a lot of our competitors have something similar. So I wouldn't say that's unique. But something we have developed is called a security sprint. And being a product manager for a while and adopting the agile methodology, I've been able to see what can happen in a week's time when doing some kind of development. So I started thinking, I'm like, well, why couldn't we do this with solving a problem? So sitting on a board, you know, sitting with a lot of other C-levels, trying to solve what at that level are pretty complex business problems. So often we're paralyzed by inactivity because there's so many things that we could be doing. So a security sprint is very simply you as the customer, you pick a problem that you're having, and then we come in, Trace3, and in 5 days, we're able to help you better understand what's the problem, what are some of the challenges, and what would a potential solution look like? What is your success criteria? We give you a roadmap that says, we now understand your problem very well, and you as the customer understand the problem equally as well now. Here's how you can fix it. And it's going to be a combination often of the right people, the right processes, the right technology. You'll hear me say those three key things over and over and over, because in my mind, you can't solve anything without those three things. And if you try to just do one of them really well, you're always going to be frustrated. because the other two are going to be lacking, and that's just difficult. So that security sprint, I've done it with a fair number of our customers, and they're always left just baffled, because at the end of it, they look at me and they go, Brad, why couldn't we do this ourselves? It seems so simple. And it really comes down to, so many organizations, they just don't talk to each other internally, especially security. Everyone is worried that security is going to, what I always laugh and say, I'll become the CIS no instead of the CISO, where they just don't want to be told, you can't do that. Sorry, security reasons, you can't do that. So they just don't really communicate. So I'd say the secret to our sauce is we get everybody together. We have a very proven process, and very quickly they're going, this is awesome. Like, we wish we could do this more often. And we're here to do that. So a lot of our customers have come back for more, as far as, hey, can you help us solve something else? Maybe not just security. Maybe it's something to do with cloud or data intelligence. So a sprint or a security sprint can be adopted for different aspects of a business. But I'd say, you know, that sets us apart. I talked a little bit earlier about our venture capitalists. We have VC briefings where we'll bring in a lot of startups, innovative, very very high level, you know, bring in a founder or CTO, and we'll do what I like to call speed dating for a customer. So you'll get 8 to 10 different technologies. They're innovative, they're cutting edge, and they come in and they pitch and do a demo for one of our customers. And it's pretty amazing to watch love connections actually happen, where the customer goes, I've been trying to solve that problem for years, and they just showed me how to do it. Let's get talking to them. So that's pretty amazing.
Wow, that sounds excellent. Can you tell us more about your security maturity workshops?
Yeah, those are pretty fun. So they typically take, you know, not like a sprint. The sprint takes, you know, 5 days. A maturity workshop can take a couple of weeks. And what it does is it gives our customers a great assessment of where their security program is today, how it actually compares to their peers and the industry, and really where they should be going. So we've had very good success with helping our customers realize that maybe they're not as far along or not as mature as they perhaps should be or want to be. So a big part of that is the assessment, and that's an aha moment for a lot of our customers, where we show them, yeah, you've passed audits before, but this isn't just necessarily an audit. We're not just checking boxes. We're actually looking at the peers and a little deeper into the systems they have, the applications they have, the role they play in the business, and we give them a very cool spider graph that shows, here's where you are.
Oh, wow.
Here's where the market says you should be, right? And then here's where you ultimately want to be. And then we help develop programs to get them there. So we're running a couple of pretty big ones right now, and we're helping our customer completely reinvent their security program. But what's amazing is it's a joint effort. It's not just Trace3 coming in there and doing it and being like, well, this is our program, and now here's our program that you have to run. It's, we're in this side by side, shoulder to shoulder. We're teaching, mentoring, we're even learning from the customer sometimes, and helping them get to a very real state of, wow, our security program is pretty awesome. We now understand everything about it, like we were talking before, that security strategy, and being able to say, all right, I got this. I've got the next 1 to 3 years. I feel so good about it. I've even got the next 5 to 7 roadmap and planned out. So it's a very, very awesome experience for our customers, I'd say.
Well, it sounds like that, yeah. Now, we know that ransomware business email compromise and one of the latest threats out there, crypto mining, crypto jacking, you know, they're dominating the threat landscape. Has Trace3 dealt with any of these or any variants of it?
More times than I would like to admit, honestly. We've done incident response several times for ransomware, crypto mining, crypto jack, I mean, you name it. And it's pretty rough on organizations. That's why we really preach and recommend protection and prevention, because there's nothing like testing your backup and restore, like going through something like ransomware and realizing that maybe you don't have a good backup or your restore is failing at 80%. And the next thing you know, you're contemplating, as we've seen a lot of healthcare do, paying the ransom. And that doesn't guarantee you're going to get the key. And we know that something's always going to be left behind. Even if you do get the key and you think that you're out of the woods, it's one of those hard decisions of, do you just burn it all down and start over? And we've had several times, even with our own, like, three-letter agencies, I won't say any of them, where they've been compromised, maybe not by ransomware, but maybe something similar, and they don't know how deep the infection goes. So I have watched entire environments become shuttered and blown away, and they bring in new hardware, new operating systems, new everything, and they start over, and they do security right from the ground up, because they can never have confidence that it's completely gone. So it's a very real thing, and it's a very difficult thing. And I would recommend that for any of your listeners, just take a second to sit back and understand how these types of attacks take place and what you are doing to prevent and protect. And do you actually have a good recovery strategy? When was the last time you tested a full, you know, backup plan? Are you replicating information that could potentially replicate the problem to your DR site? I've had customers do that where they thought they could just bring up DR and they couldn't because it had replicated. So they had crypto locked everything because it had replicated. So yeah, just understand some of those foundations of your own program.
Well, now, do you have any customer success stories, testimonials, or case studies you'd like to share with us?
I do. This is one I talk about pretty often, and it has a lot to do with our VC briefing program. So setting the stage, we have a pharmaceutical customer, and they were trying to solve a problem that all of us can relate to, that most of our drugs and medicines have a side effect. And that's because each person is pretty different and they respond differently to medicine, where I might not have a side effect. You know, Robbie, maybe you will. It's really part of our DNA. So imagine a pharmaceutical company saying, well, if we just had people's DNA on file, we could tailor our medicine to that person. But then in that same breath, imagine how much storage is needed to map that genetic profile. And think about, like, how do you secure that information? So interestingly enough, through one of our VC briefing programs, we were able to connect a cutting-edge startup, just a couple of guys out of the NSA that had created a platform that was targeting, securing, and scaling massive amounts of information. And it just so happened that we put these two together in one of our briefings, and we made that love connection. And they were able to sit down and go, this is possible. They are now able to sit down and say, if we've got your information on file, it's secure. It's leading to medical breakthroughs where we have and will continue to have medicine now without side effects. So that's one of the things when I'm talking to somebody about coming to Trace 3 to maybe work or becoming one of our customers, I sit there and with pride, I'm like, how often can you work for an organization that is really changing the world, especially in a circumstance like this? So it always makes me really proud to be part of Trace 3 and seeing how our innovation and research work together to solve these kinds of problems.
Sounds excellent. Now, there are obviously many vendors out there, you know, cybersecurity vendors, you know, out in California on the West Coast, and I've interviewed many, you know, in the southern states and the East Coast as well. What separates Trace 3 from the other vendors? Why should a customer say, hey, Brad, I want to come to you versus these other 20 companies? What separates you from the rest of the crowd?
It's hands down our people and our culture. I mean, we have some of the most leading architects and engineers really in security. They're seasoned. They've been in the field a long time. They fit our culture. And it's a culture of entrepreneurs. We're wanting to solve big problems. We're wanting to help very large organizations look at the problems that they're trying to solve in an innovative and unique way. And you can't really do that without people. And those people run our innovation practice, our research, our VC briefings. They're game changers for our customers. And I can't tell you how many times I hear, oh, Trace 3, I hear great things about you. I hear great things about your people. It's not, oh, yeah, you guys have great software, or you have, you know, amazing something else. It always goes back to the people, the culture. And I think that is something that you really can't replicate anywhere else. And I would expect that competitors of ours would tote similar things like, we got great people, we got great culture. But having been outside looking in, I would say that's a very true statement for us. We have something special, and that's why I'm here. That's why I chose to move on from my own consulting business and really help build what Trace 3 is doing. And I couldn't imagine doing it anywhere else. It's a great place. Wow.
Sounds excellent. Now, do you offer any free trials or free risk assessments for your customers before they actually become a customer?
We do. So if any of your listeners are part of an organization where, you know, maybe they're looking at their current vendor and thinking, man, I wonder if we could be doing something different. We do our sprints, our security sprint, as part of a, well, let's prove this out for you and show you what one of these actually looks like. So we've done this before where they're maybe a target account or customer for us where we've maybe not done a lot of business or we're trying to do a little bit more. It's one of those things of let's show you what's different. Let's show you how we solve these problems. And it's a great way to, I'm doing this in air quotes, try before you buy. So I consider it part of that initial pre-sales part of our business. And no real like free trials other than, you know, you're trying us on for size as far as how we would help you in a consulting agreement. Because we resell software, hardware, things like that, a lot of them offer free trials. And we've helped customers solve the problem and say, all right, you've got everything else. You got the people, you got the process. Now, maybe let's download a couple of these technologies and do a 30-day trial. We'll help them run that trial. And that's been very, very productive because so often maybe they don't have enough people. They're really heads down busy doing something. So we'll help them install everything, get the couple of trials running, do reports, set up like a executive presentation, and then they run through it and they're able to say, oh, thank you. We could very quickly compare a couple of different technologies. So that's an offering we have as well.
Excellent. Now, do you use a value-added reseller model or approach for your sales efforts?
We do. We're absolutely a value-added reseller. We're a strategic partner, trusted advisor, system integrator. We build great relationships with our customer. And as one of my mentors always says, we put the V in VAR. We put value in everything that we do.
Excellent. Now, does the federal government make use of your products and services? I would think, like in Washington, D.C., the DOD, and obviously you have that experience with NORAD. Do they make use of your services and products?
Yeah, they do in the past and currently. We've got cleared staff as well as many serving in the reserves. So some of us still carry active security clearances. So you'll see us working with a lot of the, cleared organizations that work with the government as well. They're often our customers. So yes, still very active in that part of the market and the segment.
Okay, excellent. Now, another hot button topic that's coming out this year, and in fact, I think started like probably late last year, if I remember correctly, is the C-suite. Now, whenever a cyber attack happens, everybody likes to point their finger at somebody, and whether it's fortunately or unfortunately, it's always the C-level, like the CISO or the CIO who shares the blame, and either they get fired or, what have you. What are your thoughts on making the C-suite more accountable? Because I view that, they should be accountable, but I think, leadership transcends all the way down to employees. It's really the entire organization, really, the employees that really should be, everybody should be responsible, right, to some degree or another. What are your thoughts
right.
on the C-suite accountability?
Right. I mean, I'm a follower of extreme ownership. So my take on this is you're the leader, you own it. Whether it's a mistake that someone under you makes, whether it's someone that reports to you, it's fault of one of their direct reports. Being that extreme ownership, you own it. But it comes down to your management style, your leadership style, and the culture of your company. Because when you practice extreme ownership, then your direct reports own it. Their direct reports own it. Everyone looks at it, and if you were to stand in front of an advisory board, you were going to stand in front of an inquisition, and they say, whose fault is it? You would have 50 people in the room stand up and say, fundamentally, it's my fault. Why is it your fault? Well, it's a breakdown in whatever it is that ended up causing it. So I look at it as the C-suite, they're running a business, and they need to understand all aspects of that business, especially security. And so many things, so many breaches, so many so many issues that we've had over the last 5-10 years, in retrospect, you go back and you go, man, that was negligence, or that was a business not truly understanding their systems or the risks that certain pieces pose, like giving an HVAC vendor a way too privileged account. Maybe your security was very, very solid within your organization, but if your HVAC vendor gets hacked, they can ride that connection right into your environment and have privileged access. So really CISOs and what I call BISOs, business information security officers, they need a seat at the table when it comes to a board. I find board sitting CISOs are way more effective as they've got a voice on the board, as opposed to, like, let's say it's a quarterly report on vulnerabilities and program statuses. That is far less impactful. I mean, I've prepared multiple, you know, can't be any more than 6 slides. It's got to contain very pointed information. There's a lot of stuff for the board to talk about, but man, security needs to be one of those important things. It's always fighting for funding with other technology pieces. And so often the question gets raised, what is the acceptable risk? What is going to happen? Because so often we're trained to say, if it's going to cost me more to protect an asset than it's going to be to replace that asset, why am I going to spend the money to protect it in the first place? And I think that's kind of what's wrong with a lot of these conversations, because it becomes a financial conversation where, you know, look at the breaches that impact identity. Sure, it'll cost $1 to $2 million, I'm just using fake math, to monitor people's identities. You know, if our customers get impacted, we'll monitor their identities for them. We now have cyber insurance, so if we do have a massive breach, you know, we'll pay the deductible and then pay for all of our consumers, you know, credit monitoring or identity monitoring. But what I think some of them aren't really thinking about is, what's the impact to the brand? How many people are just going to walk away and say, I'm never staying at that hotel again, I'm never shopping at that store ever again, because they drained, you know, that attacker drained my bank account, I bounced a bunch of checks, or I got a bunch of late hits on my credit that it's going to take me 6 years to get removed just by going back and forth and fighting over it. So I think that if there's more accountability from the top and everybody in an organization adopts that extreme ownership, then everybody's in it together. Everybody's on the same mission. They're trying to accomplish the same thing, but it really does start at the top, and you have to lead all the way down to that very last person that says, yeah, I'm going to do the right thing because I know my boss has my back. His boss has his back. Her boss has her back. It trickles all the way through.
Sure. Now, in terms of Trace 3, what are your plans for expansion? Are you going to offer new products or services to augment what you already have in place, or do you plan to enter new markets, or perhaps a combination of both?
Yeah, you're going to continue to see us expand, I'd say, eastward. Our presence in the Midwest, West Central is pretty good, and we've got a budding presence in, like, on the East Coast. But I'd say you're going to see us head in that direction. There could be more service offerings on the horizon. I can't say too much about it, but look for us to be acquiring more more technology, more players, more capabilities, and we're going to be growing for years to come.
Excellent. Sounds awesome. Now, let's segue into this final part of the show onto the general threat landscape. Now, I don't want to get political here. You know, I've got my views, but we keep hearing about nation-state threat actors like North Korea, China, Russia, you know, so forth and so forth. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, I know Richard Mueller came out with his report. There's no Russian meddling, you know, in terms of security on the elections, but, you know, I mean, I'm sure you have your own viewpoints, but what are your thoughts on these nations? I mean, how do we respond to them? I mean, is it like an eye for an eye? If they hit us, we hit them back 3 times harder? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I think it depends. Do they have anything of value? And that's the question that I often have many late night conversations with customers and other security professionals. And I look at it as they're here to stay, and there's only going to be more attackers joining the fray, because we have something that they want. Data is the new global currency, and they've proven that they want that, whether it's plans for ships or bombers or even just your Google password. They want it. The black market for information is booming. And the question of an eye for an eye goes back to my first statement. Like, is it anything of value? If we were going to maybe cripple systems and truly go into an all-out cyber war, as we've seen with traditional battle and traditional landscapes, you're going to take care of it for a little while, but then it's just going to be somebody else. So much of me is talking about, let's just build more resilient networks. Let's build more resilient systems. Let's build security into everything that we do. And that, I think, will help to deter some of these different nation states. They're always going to be trying. As long as there's an internet, they're going to be trying. Before that, it was spies and espionage and people embedding themselves into our nation at whatever level that they could. Sleeper agents. I mean, you can get as sci-fi or, creative as you want, but it's not going to stop. It's not going to slow down. The more connected things get, it's just going to speed up. And being what many would consider the number one nation in the world, we obviously have a target on our back. And it's just going to continue.
Right. Okay, now how do you see the cyber threat landscape changing, evolving in the coming years? And what do you think the biggest cyber threat will be? I mean, I've talked to a lot of people, I've done a lot of my own research. I feel like that, phishing is going to continue to be, the biggest thing, along with ransomware. I think the cryptojacking is going to be a big one too. But one thing that I think a lot of other people that I've interviewed on podcasts, and that critical infrastructure is going to be a huge hit too. Like in our water supplies, food supply system, electrical power grid. What are your viewpoints on that?
It's going to go back to something we've already talked about a little bit, which is IoT. I think that as long as there's an internet, as long as there's connected devices, IoT is going to become one of the most, if not the most important area that needs protecting. I mean, think of it. IoT devices are outpacing traditional laptops, servers, and machines, and it's by a staggering amount. And I also see the number of cyber defenders failing to match a lot of the demand. I believe more machine learning and AI really is going to be our only hope to help defend against the growing number of attackers, especially since an attacker can become millions of attackers, as we've seen demonstrated in Myria, in botnets. And when you're looking at a botnet being able to affect a backbone, an internet backbone, and when everything is connected together and becomes dependent upon that, one of the most damaging things that can happen is denial of service. And we see this with our medical customers very often, where if those medical devices, which are now connected to the network or the internet, if they depend on each other and there's an attack and those get disrupted, you could be looking at people actually dying. You can be looking at some kind of a malware virus or just an attack on a vulnerability where maybe somebody's hooked up to an insulin pump or they're hooked up to something that's keeping them alive. And the next thing you know, that bot or that worm or whatever it is makes it flood all of the insulin it has at once, or it shuts off that life support. Look at something like Stuxnet. where it was just a USB stick that got snuck in, and it spun those centrifuges in the nuclear facility too fast, and it slowed some of them down and made them too slow. And it wrecked those physical pieces from a cyber attack. So these are the things in my mind that are the most dangerous and the most damaging. And that's why we really, I think, need to take a step back and look. Yeah, there's going to be issues with crypto, with ransomware. There's going to be issues with a lot of different things. But I'm looking at it as our systems, our backbones are built to service a specific, like, predictable number of things. And when those things are together and orchestrated for a nefarious purpose, it's almost impossible to stop it quickly. And it takes a lot of time to be able to defend against it. So those are the things that keep me up at night. I can tell you that for sure.
Wow. Now, finally, as we wrap up our show, I asked this to all of my guests, and I keep getting asked this very same question. What are your top tips to help people and businesses to protect themselves from cyber attack? Obviously, anybody, anything is a target. But what are your off-the-shelf recommendations?
Well, I'll leave you with this. I always like to say I'll be brief, be brilliant, and then be gone. So if you can patch any of your devices, do it. Doesn't matter what it is. And if you can't patch it, try to limit what the device can talk to. I mean, it's pretty easy with most firewalls, especially enterprise firewalls. But even at home, you know, you can tune that stuff pretty easily. Make sure you change that default password on your router or on those default pieces of equipment. You know, have some kind of monitoring on your home internet. Have some kind of monitoring on your business internet. Understand what's coming in and what's going out of your network. DNS attacks are on the rise. Connecting to a DNS that you think, you know, connecting to a domain name that you think is legit, just come to find that your DNS has been poisoned and you're now connecting to a server that's maybe somewhere else, trying to collect your information. And, you know, all of this information also goes for your business. If you don't have clear visibility into what is talking on your network, east and west, north and south, do that quick. Do that first. Get rid of your passwords whenever possible. Move to multi-factor authentication. You know, something you know, something you have, something you are. And most every service out there now allows you to have some form of multi-factor. Facebook, Google does it. Protect your email first and foremost, because that's where you're able to do password resets. So make sure that password is well protected. It better yet, make sure it's a passphrase. Have it be 20 to 30 characters or more, and make sure it's unique to all of your applications and websites. Don't have the same password for multiple applications and websites. I mean, it's tempting to reuse the same password because you think, it's 28 characters, it's hard to break. But if one of the applications gets hacked, like it's happened to a lot of websites and apps, now your password is known. So just don't do it. And those are, I'd say, a couple of just foundational things that you can do to help protect you against some of the things that we talked about today.
Right. Well, just to wrap up the show, I know you talked about patching. I think one of my worst nightmares is doing the Windows updates on Windows 10. I hate that process. It seems like it takes forever. And there's a client I have. They're a threat hunting EDR cybersecurity firm. And every month, one of my blogs for them is about Microsoft Patch Tuesday. And it's just unconscionable how many vulnerabilities are in that Windows 10 system, you know. And it's just, I mean, when I got my first work computer, it literally took 6 hours for it to download all the patches and install them. I mean, I think Windows has like one of the worst patching systems on the server. I think I don't know if you share the same views on that or not, but every time I see update and shut down my crunch, how long is this going to take? So anyway.
Right. Yeah, and I do see that. I do see that a lot where, especially if it's in an organization that doesn't have a mature patch management process or a mature imaging process where that image should be updated with all of the latest patches before it's even pushed to a new client. But let's say it's painful if you walk and grab a brand new machine off of a shelf at your favorite retailer because you're at the mercy of when that image was created. A lot of them could be a year old. So you're patching. Can you imagine? So this is the thing that I always throw out there. Could you imagine if that process didn't exist? Could you imagine if there was no patching or updates to those vulnerabilities? We couldn't be connected. We absolutely wouldn't have the society that we do today because it would be incredibly insecure and painful.
I don't know. I just remember a time like when Windows, like with XP, they told you when there was, patches and you could just download whatever you thought you needed or uninstall them. But it seems like today our hands are tight. In fact, I just wrote a big blog posting on how Asus kind of went through the same thing that Microsoft keeps going through every month. Their patches were infected with malware. It wasn't so much in the source code and patches. But, their code signing procedures, I think, were hacked into. So thus, I think the cyber attacker was able to install, like, malicious software and trick the public and the private keys and things as legitimate software. Mm-hmm. So there were, like, over 500,000 users that had malware infected on their computers through really no fault of their own. It's just, I don't know. It's just my two cents. It's crazy, this whole patching process.
No,
too painful.
Yeah. Well, and you bring up a good point. You do bring up a good point. And you have honestly highlighted one of the things that we're going to see emerging in the next couple of years. And what puts us in the most danger is trust. And what you just said about those keys or about the certificates, like, trust is what ends up getting us in trouble. You trust that a user is authenticated. You trust that a user has authorization. You trust the network that you're connected to and things that you can do. So something that I would recommend that everyone looks into is something called zero trust. And more systems, networks, and organizations are starting to adopt zero trust. And you'll start to see how some of those things can mitigate a lot of the challenges that we're having based on, some of the things we've talked about today, just by measure of not trusting anything. And I know that sounds strange, but when you look at the architecture, you'll start to understand, oh, okay, that's how that works. If we had more time, we could definitely dive into it, but maybe an idea for another show.
I could other podcasts and stuff along with the IoT. So, anyway. Well, Brad, we thank you for your time this Sunday afternoon. We look forward to having our podcast with you, and hopefully we can have one just on the IoT and this whole, pain in the butt patching process that could be made better. Maybe Windows could listen to some customer complaints here and see what they can do to make things better for everybody in the end. So,
absolutely.
But thanks for your time. We appreciate it so much, Brad.
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me on.
Take care.
Bye now.